Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Hello?
Ngā mihi nui and welcome to our changing world. Ko Alison Balance tēnei. When it comes to eating, the experience is about so much more than just the food in front of you. There are many factors influencing how the food tastes and how it makes you feel. And trying to make sense of all of this is what Nazima Hamid does. Nazima is a professor of food science at Auckland University of Technology, and I'm off to meet her in the sensory lab, which is not your usual university laboratory.
We get people to eat here, so it's one of the few labs in food science where you are allowed to eat in the labs.
In fact, it's actively encouraged, so it's got a kitchen area.
So that's where we get the food preparation done.
So what kind of food do you prepare in there? All sorts?
All sorts. Whatever you can get in the supermarket, we can cook it here.
Okay, and then you've got a table where people can sit around and eat. You've got some computers, you've got some fridges.
You'll be surprised, this is not where they do the actual eating. So we trained some of our panelists here, and they do their eating in individualised booths.
So you better paint me a picture of what it is that you actually do. Like, tell me about food and sensory testing.
A lot of the job that food scientists do is to work in a company and we develop foods. Before we get those foods to the supermarket, we need to do some sort of sensory testing. And that's why we get people to taste and see if they like the food, what sensory properties they find acceptable or not acceptable, so you can do some modifications in the lab. So there's a lot of things going on before that food arrives on the supermarket shelves.
And when you talk about senses, you're talking about our standard senses, how we smell, how we taste, how we see.
Yes, so we actually use all our five senses. We often associate eating with the sense of taste. We also eat with our eyes. If you eat crisp, think about it. It's not just what you look, but what you hear.
Ah, sound as well.
Yes. And if you think about texture, there's a lot of things going on in terms of texture as well. When you touch, you feel an apple, for example, you know, or you feel the skin of an avocado, or, you know, that's all important, how firm the fruit is. So we do use our tactile senses as well when we evaluate food.
So you have to train people to be your senses, to be your tasters. Is that what you do?
Yes. So we have two kinds of panelists that can participate in the experiments here. One is consumer testing, where we assess whether people like the food or not. And with those kind of panelists, we would use consumer panelists. So they would be untrained. But the only criteria is that they are consumers of the food product. So that's the only criteria with consumer panelists. However, when you have people who are trained and you want to bring them on as panelists, you are looking at more complex attributes of the food. So why do people like the food? It's very, you know, it's related to the taste, the smell. And those two contribute to flavour. And so we need to train people who are trained panellists, and that would take maybe 20, 30, 100 hours of training before they can evaluate the specific attributes of food. So, in short, two kinds of panellists, one the consumer and one the trained panellist.
And so you said they're not actually doing their eating in here?
No. We do the training here. And we would serve the food through little boots here.
Ah, you've just slid open a little hatch in the wall.
Yeah, a hatch in the wall. So we would pass them the food through this
hatch.
It's
like an old-fashioned souvery.
Yeah. And so the panelists in there would not know what's happening here because we do not want any bias when they are evaluating the food. This is where the panelists are seated and they have a computer right in front of them.
They look like student cubby holes.
Yes. Because you do not want them to be distracted. You do not want conversations. And so on the screen, they would assess the attributes that we want them to. And you can see that we have different lighting as well. It can either be white or red.
Why the difference?
When we want them to concentrate on just the flavor, we would just use red light because we do not want the color of the food to influence their flavor perception. So say if you've got wine and they are, you know, you've made it from different grapes and you may find that the hue is quite different from one sample to another. So you don't want them to assess it in terms of appearance, but just flavor. So then you would use something like a red light. So once you're completely under red light, you cannot tell what it looks like. So that's what we call masking the color of food, because we eat with our eyes. If we see something dark, we associate it with a stronger flavor. So what we want them to do is just concentrate on the sense of taste, smell, and that's what we evaluate flavor.
You talked about them having to assess things objectively, and that must be quite important because you're not asking them to go, yum, I like this, or no, I don't like it. Are you asking them more specific questions about, you know, what's the level of saltiness? Does this taste buttery enough? Is it crunchy enough? Those kind of questions?
Correct, yes. So we would have line scales and they would be anchored none to extreme. And you would have an attribute, say, for example, smoky. So they would rate the intensity of that attribute and that's why it becomes quantitative. Even liking, we do not just ask them to say how much they like. They would have a scale. And that's how the studies in sensory science actually derive from the psychophysics law of psychology. So a lot of the work that we do very much originated from psychology, the skills that we use.
Can anyone be a panelist, or are you looking for people with particular kinds of attributes?
Before we train them, we would carry out screening tests. We also indirectly look at their personality. All right, so if you have a trained panel and you have a very dominant person, it is really difficult because this is group work, but maybe about 20%, they can be very good at differentiating the different flavors, but if they don't have the right personality and attitude, it will not work. Because remember, we don't have instruments. People, the panelists, are our instruments in sensory science.
Could you do this with instruments, do you think? Or do you think you have to be as intelligent and nuanced as a person to do it?
Until now, there are no instruments that can describe flavour. You can identify flavour compounds running chromatography, but no instruments can replace the human nose and a person's ability to describe food. And remember, we are marketing all this food to consumers, to people. We need to know what they think about it. Yeah. So no instruments will be able to replace a human panel.
Does it matter what culture your panelists come from? I'm just wondering how much of the way we assess food is cultural with the different kinds of food we might be brought up with.
Yes, so that's really, really interesting. It depends on the kind of food. So before they come and assess the food, we've got to make sure, one, they consume the food. It's no use carrying out sensory testing of cheese when the culture is you don't eat cheese. You have to find people who have been here long enough and they have consumed the cheese to actually assess it. So it's not like you get into being a panelist straight away. There are a lot of processes before you get invited to a lab like this.
I've heard of people who are super tasters. So are there some people who just would not be eligible for being a panellist just because they are too sensitive to strong food tastes?
So we would do a PROP test, a propyl thiouracil test, to check if they are super tasters. And this compound is quite bitter. But to many of us, we won't be able to sense its bitterness. It's just a small portion of the population. So this is an important test because if you have a super taster here, he or she will be so sensitive and that person would be an outlier. So that's one. Surprisingly, if you're evaluating texture, we also need to make sure they have their own teeth.
Is that because you actually use the whole of the inside of your mouth?
Correct, yeah, because it's tactile. So if you have dentures, you won't have that same experience as someone eating that food with their own teeth.
Gosh, there's a lot of things to consider.
Yeah.
Is there an age cutoff for your participants as well? And I'm thinking of older people I know who say that their ability, for instance, to smell food and taste food changes as they get older.
That's true. So it depends on what food you're testing. If you're testing a food product that's targeted to the elderly, then you would have the elderly people. And so all kinds of food are targeted to different segments of the population. You might have a younger population, you know, for this particular snack product. If you give it to someone like me, you know, I might say, I'm not going for it. You know, I want something healthy. So it also depends on the demographics.
So the food products that you test in here, are these food products that manufacturers are looking to introduce, or are these things that perhaps you might be coming up as a good diet, say for an older person who, you know, needs some help maintaining weight?
The university, I do anything. So I do a lot of research type of sensory testing. And my interest is how sound affects the flavour perception of food.
This is about the sound of the environment, isn't it?
Yeah, but not only that. When I first started my research here, it was on music.
Tell me about that.
So, all right. There have been a lot of research on sound, but mainly food sounds, crispiness of food, the sound of chewing. Then there was the group at University of Oxford where they associated piano with perception of sweet, trombone as being associated with the perception of bitterness. And there was this group in the US, and they looked at how could music affect sensory perception of emotional and non-emotional food. And so the work that we started at AUT used that as a basis. However, what we found was it's not the type of music that influenced the perception of food. So, you know, don't go and put on Mozart and think your food is going to taste better. The question is, do you like Mozart?
Ah, so it's the music that you like.
Correct. So we were the first group that found that it was not the type of music, it was how much you like the music. And that is when I worked with a psychologist who specializes in psychoacoustics. And we came up with the idea that we hypothesized that it was really how much you like the music that affected your perception of food. And that's what we found in our first study, that the valence of music...
The valence.
Valence is liking.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah. Liking of music is what influenced pleasantness of the chocolate gelatis that we tested out.
Okay, so your test food was chocolate gelati?
Yes.
Delicious. And then you played people different kinds of music?
Correct. So we had 7 or 9 music genres. And so they rated their liking for the music. And we picked the most liked, the disliked, and music that was somewhere in the middle, yeah, that they neither liked nor disliked. And when we played them that music, and it's quite interesting, my psychologist friend loves heavy metal.
I'm raising my eyebrows, but yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Some people like it.
Yeah, some people like it. So what we did was we didn't get them to hear the same piece of music, what we got them to hear is, one, the music they liked, the music they disliked, and looked at how they evaluated the chocolate gelati.
So they were then evaluating it just on the standard things you would evaluate a chocolate gelati on?
Yes, yes. So we found that in our first paper, we found that pleasantness was affected. Later on, we looked at the flavour, how the flavour changed. So if you think about it, the reason why the other researchers didn't find such a significant result is because when you hear music, you hear it over a period of time. You have to also evaluate food over a period of time. So when we do sensory testing, it's usually static. So you put the food in your mouth and you evaluate for crispiness. And it worked really well with us because we played the music over time and we could see how the changes in flavor changed over time. And that was really exciting when we found that if you listen to this light music and you had milky, chocolate, sweet, vanilla, the changes in flavor were changing, although the ice cream was the same. So in fact, we found that with this light music, it was perceived as being more dominantly bitter. And with light music, that same ice cream was dominantly sweet.
So in my case, it would be if I was listening to classical music, I'd probably say this ice cream is deliciously sweet. I am listening to heavy rock, which I hate. Oh, this is quite bitter, this ice cream.
Yeah, and that's why panelists come out from that room and think that we serve them different ice creams.
Really? It was that
Yes,
smart.
Yes, yes. That was one of the comments that we got. They said, why did that ice cream taste so bad? And I like the other one, you know, that was sweet and creamy. And this was interesting because that got us thinking, why is this happening? And because I work with a psychologist, we looked at emotions. Emotions evoked by the music. And we found a very strong correlation. The emotions evoked when you are listening to your light music is what was changing your perception of flavor.
So you started with music, you went down a path with music for a while.
Yes.
And then your research has turned a corner?
Yes, so we could see the effects of music. So we found what's happening. So then the next thing was sound. If you think about it, whenever we eat, now we never eat in silence. We're eating when we're on the road, we're eating in a cafe, there are always sounds. And we're eating with our headphones on, yeah? So the next study looked at how different environments affected your flavour perception of ice cream.
Great. Can we talk about that and just pop out and just go for a little walk? Because I think you did the testing in different environments that are actually, there's examples of them not far away.
So yeah. Far. Okay.
We're leaving the sensory lab, heading into slightly less controlled conditions. Come out onto Simon Street, which is a pretty well-known Auckland street.
Yes.
And there's a bus pulling away at the bus stop.
Yes. So this is where we did the experiment. So we got the people seated here eating ice cream. And of course, we wanted this during the time where it's the busiest, where we had a lot of buses. Just listen. It's a lot more noisier here. Yeah? You hear the cars, you hear the buses. And you get people eating ice cream exactly out here. So what we did was we set it up and we got them to evaluate sensory perception of chocolate gelati over time. Yeah.
And what do they think of gelati when eaten at a bus stop?
You'll be surprised. It's more bitter. Yeah. Yeah. And the emotions were interesting. There were a lot of negative emotions associated with eating in this environment.
Even though it was a really nice chocolate gelati.
Yeah. So it was the environment probably that was becoming more dominant. And so that influenced their flavor perception of the ice cream. We also measured their electrophysiological responses. So what happened to their heart rate? What happened to their skin conductance? Because emotions can be measured objectively using a scale, but your body physiologically is also reacting, is also evoking that emotion. And so we looked into that sort of measures as well.
And what happened to people's heart rates and skin conductance?
That's a good one. So there were significant differences in the different environments. And so we knew for sure that emotions played a big role.
So here at the bus stop, people, what manifested, just being more stressed in general?
Yes. Yes. So, you know, we probably need to rethink where we eat.
So I was feeling a bit sorry for that cafe then, which has tables outside at a bus stop.
Yeah.
People probably don't like their food as much as if they ate it inside or in a park or somewhere. So a bus stop was one environment for you. What were the other ones?
Yeah, we'll be walking there shortly.
Okay, we'll head away from the bus stop.
Yes.
So have you tried experiments, like you've used music, have you also done experiments playing, I don't know, lovely sounds of nature, bird calls and things?
We've done that, yes.
And that made people think that the food was sweeter and creamier?
Yes, yes. So what we did was we had a cafe background sound and we had birds sounds playing at the back and we had a sound of a drone as well. We overlaid one cafe with a drone sound and that wasn't good.
Bitter chocolate again?
Yes, bitter chocolate again. Yeah. So you can change the experiences people have by maybe having sounds, pleasant sounds in the background, not just music.
This is sounding to me like you really need to pick your cafe as to whether they play the kind of music you like and whether they're near a park and not a bus stop.
Yeah, you can even play park sounds in the cafe if you wanted to, because that's what we did. And you can get quite interesting results playing different sounds, and that's why I'm now doing more sounds and looking at the combination of sound and music. So that's another PhD, you know, work that we are carrying out at AUT.
So it's a cafe that's set back from the road.
So we had a table just over there and we got them to eat the chocolate gelati.
So there's a radio playing and you can hear people talking at different tables.
Mm.
What did they reckon about the chocolate in here?
It was sweet. It was okay. Yeah, the flavour was good. So this is one of the few places where the ice cream tasted good or perceived to have positive sensory attributes. So what we did in our pilot studies to make sure how people felt in those different environments before they even tasted food. So we wanted to make sure they are different, because it's no use if you're having the same emotions. Yeah, like when we did the bus stop, we found that people were very stressed and they came up with, you know, disgust, anger, tense. We knew people were feeling different in those environments. And then that's how we piloted which places we should select for the actual eating experiment.
So how many people do you put through these experiments?
50, 60 people.
Oh, so quite a few.
Yeah. So in summer, this is really nice. You feel like you're in a treehouse because mm-hmm. you have the trees outside.
Yeah, so this is probably the closest that AUT has to almost a nature space, because, as you say, it's got those trees.
Yeah.
They're leafless at the moment, but when they're in flower, you would be surrounded by greenery.
Yeah, yeah.
And people found the chocolate ice cream sweet and creamy here?
Yes, but sweeter in the cafe. There are differences, but they are more similar than the bus stop condition or even the lab condition. So you've got to rethink about where you carry out sensory testing, because when you're measuring flavour, the different environments will influence the flavour of food. And so the next thing that people are researching is maybe use VR. Get them in different immersive environments. And so there are a lot of research going into that now. And I'm thinking about that sort of research as well, because we can see that just putting them in different environments, they get different flavour perception. And you have to measure the true perception of flavour by consumers, by people who eat their food. And you can see that, you know, the environment is making such a big difference on how they perceive the food. Yeah, so I'm looking at satiety as well.
So satiety is that feeling of fullness and satisfaction,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So if you think about it, that's a big area to look into. It's not just flavour, how much you eat. You know, if you eat in front of the TV, you eat more because, you know, your focus is on something else. You might find that different environments may affect satiety and not just flavour. Because if it's affecting flavour, it's affecting a lot of other things, how much you eat, because you are not concentrating on the food. You know, which is dominant, the food or the environment? What do you hear? These are all influencing your perception of food.
Thanks, Nazima. Nazima Hamid is a professor of food science at Auckland University of Technology. Now, here's a short excerpt from RNZ's Black Sheep podcast, in which William Ray focuses on shady, controversial and sometimes downright villainous characters of New Zealand history. In Invasive, he investigates the story of Stuart Smith, who released thousands of invasive fish into New Zealand's rivers, lakes and streams between the 1960s and the late 2000s.
If you cast a fishing line into a pond or a stream around Auckland or Waikato, you might hook something which looks a bit unusual. Fish with bright silver scales and vivid red fins. It's called a rudd, and like a lot of animals which call New Zealand home, it's not native to this country. The Department of Conservation's website describes rudd as the possums of the waterways, voracious feeders which chew through native plants and hoover up small invertebrates, outcompeting smaller native fish. Rudd are considered a noxious pest in most parts of Aotearoa, but they're now so common in Auckland and Waikato, they've been declared an acclimatised species. That means they're so widespread, the authorities have just given up trying to get rid of them. DOC's website goes on to say this.
The species was illegally introduced into New Zealand in 1967 via a private consignment of juvenile rudd, which were then reared to adulthood and encouraged to breed. The resulting fish were then deliberately and strategically introduced into a number of lakes and ponds in the Waikato. Rudd have since been progressively spread illegally around lakes, ponds and rivers throughout the North Island, as well as Canterbury and Nelson.
But the Department of Conservation's website really sells this story short. It doesn't mention that all this illegal introduction and spreading was mostly the work of one man. He was a devout communist with a stubborn streak a mile wide. A conspiracy theorist who spent World War II poaching trout in a conscientious objector camp. A kind of environmental imperialist who went on a 40-year crusade, illegally stocking New Zealand's waterways with all kinds of introduced fish. His name was Stuart Smith.
He can be positioned alongside the folks that brought us rabbits and stoats and possums.
This is Brian Winters. He's a Tauranga-based author who wrote an authorised biography of Stuart Smith. It's called That Pommy Bastard.
He can be positioned there. No question about that.
Initially, I thought the title of Brian's book was maybe a little bit harsh, but it turns out Stuart Smith himself suggested it. He asked for the book to be written as part of his will after he died in 2008. That might tell you something about his character and his sense of humour.
That was from the Black Sheep story Invasive. And if you'd like to listen to the whole thing, you can find it on the podcast page at rnz.co.nz. Tonight's Food and Your Senses story is on the Our Changing World webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. And we are RNZ Science on Facebook and Twitter. Many thanks for your company. But for now, it's good night from me, Alison Balance. Mā te wā.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.